no 64º Block Talks, a gente fala com a doutora Jane Thomason, autora e pesquisadora, que conta como o blockchain pode transformar o mundo na prática. Essa entrevista está em inglês. Eu sou Maurício Magaldi e esse é o Block Drops, o primeiro podcast em português sobre blockchain para negócios. As notícias que você ouve aqui não têm qualquer vínculo com o meu trabalho atual, não configuram nenhuma forma de patrocínio, propaganda ou incentivo para o consumo e têm o foco exclusivamente educacional para o mercado.
All right, everybody. We have Dr. Jane Thomason, who's going to tell us who she is and what she does with blockchain. Thanks for joining us here at Block Talks.
Thank you, and hello, Brazil. It's great to join you. Happy New Year to all of you. I'm actually in Dubai at the moment, and what I'm really interested in and have been since about 2016 is around blockchain and other technologies as well, because it's progressed a lot since then with AI and DeFi and NFTs and metaverse and everything, and social impact. So how we can really use these technologies to create social transformation. So I talk, I write, I work with projects that I think are doing good work, and just generally try and help more like the common people understand why blockchain is important and how it can actually help solve some of the problems that they have in their lives.
Absolutely. And how did you find blockchain? What was your professional or your life's journey until you came across this new family of technologies or this new opportunity to transform how stuff works?
Well, I worked most of my life in emerging economies, mainly in healthcare, and I had a company and we would contract in to the likes of the Australian Aid Program, USAID, the development banks and so forth, and help countries develop their healthcare systems, mainly in Asia and the Pacific. So I'm very sorry, I've never even been to Latin America, which is terrible, and I hope you'll invite me. But so what I understood for so many years was the kinds of challenges that people faced when they were thinking about reaching remote and isolated populations, people without identities, trying to get immunizations to children and mothers to maternity and so forth. And then in about 2010, my son actually said to me, "Mum, they've got this new digital currency called Bitcoin. You should buy some." And unfortunately, I didn't buy any and I completely ignored him. And then he came back to me in about 2016 and he said, "Hey, Mom, did you buy any of that Bitcoin that I told you about?" And I said, "No." So when he told me it was about 10 cents and by 2016, I think it was around 3,000. And he said, "Now listen, Bitcoin's built on blockchain and that's going to change everything. And you really need to listen to me about this and learn about it." So that's how that's actually how I started to get interested in it. And I started to read about it and, you know, look at YouTube videos and things and try and understand what it was and why I should care about it. And then, you know, without going into too big of a story, one day I kind of had an epiphany when I was thinking about a humanitarian crisis, which was actually the tsunami in Banda Aceh in Indonesia, where 200,000 people lost their lives. And I sort of, we had been up there, my company worked up there in the reconstruction, and it was chaos because not only no one knew who was washed to sea, no one knew who the people were that were left behind, identities were lost, bank records were lost, health records were lost, and all of the catastrophe that you can imagine. And then I just had this moment, which was if everyone had had a kind of, you know, secure identity hashed onto a blockchain somewhere up there in the cloud linked to all of those other records, it wouldn't have changed the tragedy, but it would have made the reconstruction so much easier. And it was from that moment I just suddenly went, aha, I get this now. And so then I started working really hard to be able to share those kinds of stories with people, link with the blockchain community, with developers, with people who were doing projects in those areas. So that was how I got into it.
Well, that's quite a nice journey, and indeed somewhat similar to most of the people that we bring to the show. Now, when you first found this and you had this realization that this could be transformative to most of the processes that require the data to be reliable, how was the first interaction of getting the technology out to people? What was the use case that you actually put out to function, and how was the reception from either companies, governments, or people that you were dealing with? How was that, and how has been the process since then?
Okay, so what actually I did at that time, this is 2016, I was working in a country called Papua New Guinea, which has got around 85% of the population are unbanked. And it's very remote and isolated. And, you know, my company had been working on some projects up there, and we were working with the central bank. And the governor of the central bank was really interested in financial inclusion, and he wanted kind of, you know, one of his legacies to be that. So we persuaded the central bank to come with us to London, and we sponsored the London Blockchain Week hackathon in 2017, and we made the problem of the hackathon around financial inclusion in Papua New Guinea. So actually it was amazing. You know, we had 200 developers all working in teams trying to solve these very difficult problems in a country like PNG, and the central bank guys were there. And actually, after that, the two winners, we took them back to PNG to further develop their projects and, you know, sort of test the viability. And even though those particular two developers who had won didn't continue, the initiative continued, and the central bank continues with it now. And it's got a digital ID project, and it's working with, you know, other groups trying to use this for financial inclusion in PNG. So that was sort of like the first one. And then the second one for me, because I had a lot of background in women's and children's health, was I wrote an article again in 2017 trying to talk about how blockchain could help, you know, with some of the issues with women's and children's health. So and then I did one on climate finance, and then I did one on poverty. So I started saying, what are the problems that I know about that we've been working with, and then how can this be used, and who are the people who are developing those solutions? So that was kind of my approach in 2017. And then just going to conferences, going to hackathons, talking to developers, talking to projects, and trying to find out more who was interested, who was building, how could I get my ideas out there so people would be inspired to do some social impact projects instead of just, that's ICO year 2017, everyone was doing ICOs. So trying to get some interest in something other than that.
Got it. The regular podcast is built on analysis of use cases. And one family of use cases that we like to talk about the most is the so-called blockchain for good or blockchain for social good. And it seems that your experience with the use of blockchain moves towards that space really recurringly. In that space, what are the most promising prospective use cases you're seeing now that we are talking about NFTs and DeFi and integration with Internet of Things devices, the actual use of blockchain, say for food safety or for, you know, vaccine traceability? These are all use cases that, in my perspective personally, increase how well we are as humanity. What are the things that you're seeing at the front lines that you see as most promising in the space of the blockchain for good?
Yeah, so I want to answer that in two ways, because back in 2017, 2018, along with a colleague of mine, we wrote a book called Blockchain for Social Transformation. And what we did was called Blockchain for Global Social Change. And what we did at that time was we looked at a number of case studies of people who were back in 2017, 2018, actually building things. So the first thing I want to say is, like, before we got excited with NFTs and shiny new things, there's a bunch of people who've been building back from 2017, 2018, in the areas of healthcare supply chains, agriculture supply chains, identity, financial inclusion, humanitarian, and they now are actually quite well developed. So I think we've got those ones who've now been building for several years that we're really building up a body of evidence about the work that they've been able to do and the impact that they're having. And then I think we've got these kind of exciting new worlds that we're all learning about together. So obviously, you know, DeFi offers promise to so many people, you know, in the sense democratizing access to financial services that weren't available to people before. And so I think that, you know, there's a whole body of promise and work there. Obviously, during the pandemic, one of the things that happened was tremendous acceleration of innovation. But in healthcare, things like, you know, secure sharing of health data, remote care, supply chains, payments, all of those things that blockchain can help with really move fast during the pandemic because we needed it. And then I think you had all of these amazing developers and innovators sitting at home with nothing to do, couldn't go anywhere. So then they started inventing, you know, NFTs and started thinking about the metaverse. And the big one for me was play to earn games, because this actually kept people out of poverty during the pandemic. And I mean, obviously the best known case is in the Philippines, but I believe that people in Brazil are playing Axie Infinity and, you know, making money out of it. So it's just, you've created new ways for people to earn income that didn't exist before. So it's new economies and new jobs. And what I'm hoping is that people will, you know, kind of ride on the back of what people like Axie Infinity have done and the way that they've got the scholarship programs going, and go, how else can we use our technology to create these new income streams and new opportunities for people? And then finally, even though everyone's been sort of playing around with AR, VR, AI for ages, just this year the metaverse has really got going. And so everyone's building metaverses, thinking about how to use them, you know, buying up land in them. And I think it's, again, really interesting to think about how that can be used, not just for kind of social engagement, but it can. But for example, the city of Seoul in Korea has announced that it's going to create its entire kind of civil administration in a metaverse. And then you go, I wrote an article recently about how it could be used for healthcare and how it would actually help in a number of different areas with healthcare. So I think we're kind of at that moment of trying to race to keep up with the technology, with what people are building, trying to imagine what that's going to mean for all sorts of verticals, if you like, and help people to understand how they can leverage it. But also there's still problems, as you know, DeFi, for example. So much money's been stolen out of DeFi projects. And, you know, people talk about DAOs, but, you know, there's a lot of questions about how decentralized DAOs are and some of the vulnerabilities and so forth. So, and then, you know, obviously Ethereum got so popular, the gas fees got so expensive that, you know, everyone's now trying to build all of these alternative platforms. And we've had the criticisms about the energy use of especially Ethereum and Bitcoin. And so we're going green. So there's loads of stuff going on. But I think with regard to NFTs, because that's the final one I don't think I've mentioned yet, is that at the moment it does remind me a bit of the ICO era. And it's like hot and everyone's doing an NFT and everyone's spending money on NFTs. But I think the next iteration is, how are we going to use NFTs, you know, as almost kind of, you know, digital credentials, digital licenses for so many different things? And then how can we use them? So, you know, different projects for music and for art, How do we use them to reward the creators? How do we engage the creators with the fans? You know, what can we use NFTs for that enables this whole kind of social community to be able to interact in ways that are much more personal than, you know, the liking someone's Instagram post? And, you know, I think these kind of community-owned economies are the one of the next big things in terms of the way we interact socially.
Absolutely. And in terms of the different, and I call the DAOs and the NFTs and DeFi, they are families of use cases that are being explored in different avenues in the industry right now. But one thing I haven't seen explored within any of these is universal basic income. And UBI is something that is this utopic concept that for the longest time we thought that because the governments charge taxes, then they should be the ones to provide UBI at any given point. We're seeing that there are experimentations in the public side that are dealing with that. But now with blockchain and this massive scale of available funds everywhere through all of these use cases you mentioned, it seems that UBI is going to come from somewhere else, yet it's not yet defined. What is your take in, you know, in the like this sort of overlap between blockchain and UBI?
So a couple of, I'm watching projects, you know, to see, because obviously I can see that this is possible, but I don't think any of us are quite sure how to make it take root. Because, you know, there's one thing to have an idea, but you need a community, you need to reach the people that you're trying to get the basic income to. I mean, I think there is a question in terms of kind of thinking about the sustainability of it, whether you just make income available to people or whether they do anything in return for it, you know, and I, you know, I think there's kind of moral and ethical questions there. But I've been watching Good Dollar, which is by the people who do eToro. And I mean, I just follow it because they started off saying, well, you know, just get on this site and everyone can get good dollars every day. And so you can apply for your good dollars and end up with some thousands of good dollars. And then what they obviously did was when the size of their marketplace, if you like, got big enough, then they started creating a marketplace so people with good dollars could spend those good dollars. And then there's a similar, not similar, but related kind of project called Electronium, where they started off giving people their ETN, which is designed for low-income people, and then they allowed them to get free airtime for the ETM. And then they created something which they've, I think they've called it AnyTask, but it's one of these ones where you can do tasks and get paid in ETM. So I think what we're seeing is a number of these different projects which are allowing people to get access to income as long as they've got a mobile phone and, you know, access to mobile technology, they're able to get money. Now, how you create that, you know, on a national scale or a global scale in a way that people know about and that they're able to access and benefit from, I don't think we're there yet. What I am confident of is the technology is capable of doing it. I'm not sure that there's this kind of confluence. The technologists have got the idea, but often they don't know how to execute in context. You know, so if it's, let's say we're targeting people in southern Sudan or in the Amazon, they don't necessarily have the experience of thinking about culturally and socially and all of the other things that it would take to be able to share the benefits with people in the remote areas. So I think we've got that kind of execution challenge still, and definitely there's, you can do those kinds of things, but ultimately in any given jurisdiction, you're probably going to run up against government. And so I think there is conversations that need to happen with government. So at the very least, they don't shut it down. And at best, they actually embrace and support it. So I think there's a way to go. I'm very confident we'll get there, but I don't think we're that close.
You mentioned governments and the shut it down possibility of things, and we're seeing a number of countries, especially in the emerging economies, trying to become more crypto friendly, if you will, which is a good thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be allowing everything, but that the legislation and regulations are more supportive of the new models that are possible, made possible by blockchain. In that regard, we're also discussing the central bank digital currencies. China has its own. There's a, you know, the stable coins are sort of a preemptive movement towards the digital dollar. Brazil is specifically working on the digital real for next year. Mexico just announced theirs for 2024. In that space where we see the sort of overlap between government-issued currency and the blockchain infrastructure, lies a big danger of surveillance state. What is your take on CBDCs in that regard, and what would be either other opportunities that you see from CBDCs versus what are the risks or challenges in the space?
Well, look, let me again step up to a helicopter view, because I think that, you know, you're quite right. So you've got obviously China rolling out the digital yuan, and the question about whether they're going to roll that out also to the Belt and Road countries. You know, that's 110 plus countries that they could be requiring to use that. And then you've kind of got the US, which is historically, at least in our lifetime, been the kind of leader of the global monetary system. And I see kind of China creating competition in that regard, but not just China. And that's where I think we have to think about it, because then you've got all the big tech. So Facebook sort of got out in front and said they were going to do Libra, which is now Diem, and now they're doing Meta. But, you know, all the big techs are doing financial services because they've got the communities and they can offer different services, and they've got so much data on all of the people in their communities that they can absolutely surveil, and they can also predict your behavior and influence, you know, your buying patterns. And then you've got, you know, the blockchain community building their stable coins and doing things like that. So I think we've got like a really interesting moment in the global financial system that I don't see anyone is sort of looking across at the top level, and how all of these different kind of somewhat competing parts are going to come out in the end, whether we'll have, you know, kind of two parallel global financial systems, one which is all the China countries and one which is all the US countries. And if you talk to, you know, kind of financial scholars, a lot of them are saying, well, what is the role of central banks? If you can have this kind of programmable money, what do you need central banks for? And then obviously there's real question about the future of retail banks with DeFi. So I didn't answer your question at all properly, but I think we're at a moment in time where we don't know what's going to happen in the global financial system. But in terms of surveillance, we are living in a world where people have willingly given up their data for at least a decade. And so I'm not quite sure how we can even talk about privacy anymore, because everyone gives up their data every time they get on their mobile phone. And it's going to be hard to kind of claw back from that. And one of the topics that, you know, I like to talk about is around, and again, we did a book on this last year around the applied ethics in a digital world. So how do you think about ethics when things are automated? You know, decisions are being made by algorithms that affect millions of people. And the developers who've done the algorithms may have been well-intentioned, but not given one thought to the kind of ethical implications of what the algorithms are doing. So I think we've got a lot of catch-up to do and a lot of thinking to do as all of these kind of new and exciting things roll out, you know, about how we protect people in these settings. Because even in humanitarian settings, and that's an area that I'm interested in, often refugees in humanitarian settings are persecuted populations. So if you're starting to collect identity and all of this other data on them, and they're moving, or people don't want them to, you know, come to their countries or anything like that, you've kind of created the ability to be able to surveil vulnerable and persecuted populations. So there's kind of a lot in your question, and I think very few of us have really thought about the answer to that, particularly in the free world, because we don't think we should be surveilled, but we are. And especially with COVID, like we've given up everything now.
It's interesting that there's always some major event that sort of bumps another notch in eating up our privacy, right? It was 9/11 was one major one in the US that then sort of cascaded to other Western countries. Now COVID. I'm pretty sure that there would be others. But if there is an opportunity for us to, as you said, claw back from where we are in terms of privacy and data, then Web3 might be the situation where we can finally have that adult discussion as to what that means, what ethics means in this new scenario. And even regulators have the opportunity to say, well, you want to innovate, so I'll help you write your smart contracts with the regulations embedded. So now you can do any innovation you want and still be under the regulatory framework that we think works for this particular situation. So, and it, of course, sort of sets a new challenge for governments and public administrations and all that, because, you know, there's 180 plus 190 countries in the world. They have their own governments, and now they have a common global platform they can interact on blockchain. So it's a complete new challenges in that space. And you might have answered this, but I'll ask it anyway, because I feel this is an important question for our guests. We're talking about Web3, right? The web of value, as Tapscott's named it. What are the challenges or features from the previous iterations of the web that we have to fix so we don't end up in the same situation we're in? You mentioned the data privacy, which I agree, but are there any others? And if there are, which ones are them that we must make it right, or we will end up in the same place, even though we now have blockchain?
Yeah, so obviously data privacy and security are important. I mean, the other one that I think is important is around digital inclusion, because, you know, so one thing is, let's say 70% of the population have access to mobile phones, and that number needs to go up. But just because they've got a mobile phone doesn't necessarily mean that they can understand and access the benefits of Web3. And so I think more thought needs to go into that. And one of the areas that, you know, I've thought about is dealing with illiteracy, because in a lot of countries, you know, the poorest people are not literate. And so if they've got a smartphone, they may not be able to use it. So things like voice activation and trying to think about making the user experience really easy, and also thinking about cultural acceptability and appropriateness, because, you know, not every country, not every community is the same. So I think, you know, these are the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about. And, you know, I think the other one is just back to that ethics, is trying to think about. So, for example, we have challenges with mental health with our current, you know, system of the internet. There'll probably be more problems with Web3. For children, how do we protect children in the metaverse? Questions like that. So I think that we've got a lot of those kind of moral and ethical questions to think about, because if we're going to create a distributed, inclusive, democratized system that we all talk about and we all say that Web3 will do, we actually need to proactively think about what it will take to make that system equitable and inclusive and protecting people's rights and protecting people's privacy.
No, I fully agree. And the fact that we're, as you mentioned, entering a space in the economy where play-to-earn games will make up a good chunk of the basic income or the minimum wage for families in emerging markets, we're just counting the upside. We have yet to understand what the downside is in terms of time dedication, overall public health, that, you know, corresponds to the time that, you know, instead of now doing physical labor, people are now sitting in front of their computers. What does that mean for public health in general? Are we going to become more lazy, physically lazy for that? And what does that mean for our health? You know, so there's all of these side effects that we have yet to touch upon that I don't think, because, you know, the hype is so big and we're so excited about the technology, we might not yet have reached the point to where, okay, the metaverse is making us even fatter or even more obese. And those will be the headlines at some point. So I fully appreciate that perspective as well.
But just on that one, I want to, because I don't know if you've seen this yet, one of the projects that I've been following is one which is actually, kind of play to exercise. It's called GenoPet. So it's sort of like a little Pokemon kind of Axie creatures, and you grow and benefit your creatures every time you do some kind of physical activity. So I think people are, you know, kind of trying to get there, and people are also looking at things like earn to learn. So thinking about how you can really transform the education system into something where people are really motivated to learn, and then they can get paid to learn. So I think there's some super interesting ideas being experimented with at the moment. But as you say, what we need to be doing is going, what are the risks? And you've picked on the one of, you know, being sedentary and being unfit. And then people are going, okay, what can we do to mitigate against that risk? So I think we'll have this constant kind of cycle of, here's a risk we're going to be facing. What can we do either as we build or in some other sort of platform or something to overcome that? And I just think we're in a constant learning cycle. We don't know what's right and wrong, but I think what's incumbent on us is to be learning and reporting back and sharing so that we're getting those lessons and we're putting it back into the community so they can prevent those harms.
Which is a hallmark characteristic of this community, which is the learning and sharing. I think we finally got to a point in the industry where we understand that withholding our perspectives is less than what it could be for sharing them. And you know, I thank you for coming over to Block Talks and sharing your own perspectives. And this is what I think makes this work that I do with the podcast so incredible and humbling, is that, you know, I have access to, you know, the people like yourself that are, you know, doing great things at the forefront, and then come over and share with us here and with the audience. So appreciate that. Now, we're almost done with the allotted time, and I wanted to just open up for your final remarks, Dr. Ann. You know, share with us, you know, your, you know, perspectives, what you're going to be up to in the new year, what are the news, how people can find you online and maybe follow you or stalk you, whatever, you know, people do these days online, and how to reach out to you in terms of, you know, services, your perspectives, how to get your books and all that.
Yeah, look, I mean, please link in with me or follow me on Twitter. I'm active on both. But I want to, we didn't kind of circle back enough to the kind of regenerative economy, green economy, and so forth. And since we're talking about Brazil and you've got the Amazon, I think some of the incredible things people are trying to do to preserve natural habitats like the Amazon and creating ways to incentivize landowners to preserve the forests instead of selling the wood or selling the land for commercial crops are really, really powerful and important. And so I just want to kind of share that thought with people. There's so much that could be done with blockchain, you know, not only for the poverty aspect, but for really trying to preserve some of the natural heritage that you have in Brazil and in Latin America. And we don't want to lose sight of that either. But, you know, I think we're just in one of the most exciting times that I've ever seen. And for everyone who's interested, sort of like lean in, be part of it and be trying to build back better after the pandemic and giving an opportunity, because this isn't a zero-sum game. You know, people talk about the abundance economy. We can all win here. And as you say, it encourages us to collaborate, it encourages us to share, and that's what we should be doing.
Absolutely. Dr. Thomason, thank you so much for accepting our invitation. And I truly hope that we can stay in touch and report back at some point in the future, so you can come over and tell us that we fixed everything. We are now living a UBI utopia with physical preservation of our natural goods. And that happened because we are doing stuff right and ethically on the blockchain. So let's hope for that and let's work for that. Again, thank you so much for taking the time and bringing such incredible insights and your experience to our audience. Thank you so much and have a great year. Happy 2022.
Thank you and happy new year to you and all your listeners.
Você pode ouvir o Block Drops Podcast nas plataformas Anchor FM, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, Numis e iColab. Entre em contato conosco através do Instagram, Block Drops Podcast, no Twitter, Block Drops Pod, e por e-mail, blockdropspodcast@gmail.com. Salve para a doutora Jane Thomason, que tomou esse tempo para falar com a gente e trazer tantas experiências interessantes na sua jornada com o blockchain. Não se esqueça de deixar o seu rating aí no seu tocador de podcast favorito. A gente fica por aqui. Até a próxima. Tchau.